Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Son of a Blitch podcast. I'm your host, George Blitch, and today I got to sit down with the one and only John Norris. If you guys are not familiar, he is a retired special operations lieutenant. He started out as a game warden in California, and now he is a man of such knowledge from all the different things that he has gone through, fighting the cartels and this illegal marijuana grow, and all the devastation, environmental and otherwise, that has caused, that he's at the forefront of the tip of the spear, really letting people know about what's going on. He was recently testifying in Congress, telling the congressmen and women about what's going on, why we need to be protecting our borders against all the different things and the atrocities that these cartels are bringing across. It's not just the tainting of weed. We're talking about marijuana. We're talking about, you know, fentanyl, you know, methamphetamines that are coming across, and as well as obviously human struggling. So we talk about all that. Obviously his firsthand account of what he battled in California, the marijuana enforcement, you know, task force that he put together, the MET. And there's just a myriad of stories here that he shares about his time in service. And, you know, the books that, you know, came from that, the first one, The War in the Woods, that he wrote. And then the next one, Hidden War. It's on its second edition. There's actually audio book now too, and Kindle available here. This one actually has a foreword from Jack Carr, which is just a wonderful edition. And this second edition, actually, if you haven't owned the first, you need to check out the second one, because there's all sorts of new photos and different things that are going on, new chapters, new forwards there. He really kind of paints a picture of what's been happening since the first edition. You know, no doubt he's got a third book on the way. He kind of hints at that, as well as some feature film documentary stuff that's going on. But we'll have him back on to announce that and kind of give a little more details when that comes through. And we also get to talk about, you know, aside of these amazing knives that he's developed with V knives and the Trailblazer, of which I use every day, my EDC, my everyday carry, is that knife. We talk about his musical career, most recently playing with Area 56, a wonderful group that's up in, you know, Montana there where he is. These guys have so many great tunes that they're covering. And he talks about some other, you know, original music that he's gotten a part of recording, and some things will be coming out soon. So I don't want to give it all away. I want you guys to tune in and learn everything, but make sure you hit the description below and check out all the links to everything he's doing, whether it's the podcast he's hosting with Warden's Watch or Thin Green Line, whether it's the, you know, television shows he's been a part of, or, you know, the authoring of these amazing books here. You know, you guys got to check these out. He is a man of many talents, and as well as many stories to share. You know, you might have heard of him, Meat Eater, Joe Rogan's podcast as well. There's so many things we can go into more depth through, but I think we really scratched the surface and dove into enough to give you a really good idea of what John's been a part of and all the wonderful things he's sharing. And I couldn't be more blessed and honored to have him on this podcast. So without further ado, here is my podcast with John Norris. Y'all enjoy. Well, John, how the heck are you doing today, man?
George, I am great. It's great to be on your show finally. I know we've been trying to get this together for about a year, and here we are finally, pumped. Good to see you, man.
Yeah, man. Good to see you. And I mean, it's not like you've been busy or anything, testifying in front of Congress, traveling around, putting out your second edition of your books, filming stuff. I mean, we are going to dive into all that. But I figured, you know, just for listeners who may not be fully familiar with you and your story, and we're going to walk through kind of some chronological events here, I figured we'd start at the beginning. Why don't you talk about where you grew up, your love of the outdoors, and kind of that connection to nature that obviously you care so much about and we've seen throughout your career. So just maybe start us at the beginning, man. Where'd you grow up, and kind of, you know, who were some of your mentors guiding you in that outdoor space?
Yeah, you know, George, it all started, you know, in childhood. I come from a family of conservationists. You know, granddad was career Navy, you know, nine kids on my dad's side of the family, raised fishing, hunting, respect for everything in the outdoors. And then my dad, my uncles primarily were my main guidance. In fact, my dad helped me get through the hunter education course in California, where I was born and raised, at 9 years old. You know, I could hardly hold up mom's Model 50 20 gauge, but got my first teal with him after passing hunter education and the duck blind. And then it was just off to the races. You know, I was the kind of guy that spent most of my time when I wasn't at school or doing part-time jobs through high school and college, et cetera, before fishing game, I got the opportunity to be a game warden. You know, I wasn't going on frat trips. I wasn't hanging out on campus. I was going into the state park. I was going on ranches. I grew up with a ton of cattle ranchers that had poaching problems on their property. They ended up having cartel grows. You know, there's brandings, and as you know, being down in the great state of Texas where you're at, you know, I call Texas True America South, and I'm up in Montana now, True America North. So yeah. I think we got the North and South covered, brother.
We do.
But this thing about, you know, I'm working with, I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but
it's okay.
The cattlemen, you know, and the cattle families that are still working ranches in the Silicon Valley foothills, which is oxymoronic. You don't think of the Silicon Valley, the tech capital of the world, having cattle ranches and a ton of wildlife and resources all over, but you do. You get out of the San Jose Bay Area where I grew up, and it's nothing but rural. It's foothills, remote canyons. Both my books go into it. So working around conservationists like that, you know, working and protecting cattle ranches from poaching, from environmental destruction, but then seeing the conservation in cattlemen, the conservation in everybody that loves the outdoors. And I kind of got hooked with that. And that's all I spent my time doing. And then in 1992, halfway through grad school, I was a criminal justice major at state, kind of waiting. It was really hard to get hired. It was affirmative action impacted to become a game warden in my state, because you'd have like 4 openings and like 10,000 applicants. And if you weren't a military veteran with preference points, you can only get so high up on the list. Right. I was one of the civilians that got as high as I could, and I was right on the bubble at 95%, and then was able to get into an academy with mostly veterans and other law enforcement guys changing careers in 1992, and spent, you know, all throughout California, primarily the bulk of it in the Santa Clara, Silicon Valley area where I grew up as a game warden. And then much later, the team leader and the co-developer of our marijuana enforcement team, our tactical unit, and never really left home from that standpoint because we were statewide. But that's how it started. And man, what a blur it's been. I mean, we're talking like 35, 40 years of just there it was. And it was such a blessing, brother, to do that. I don't even call it a job. It's a way of life. It's in your blood, you know, and we don't do it for the money because game wardens are not paid, you know, that well, comparatively speaking to other law enforcement in most states. And there's that issue going on, but we're doing it for the passion of the job. We're doing because we just love wildlife, wild lands, and waterways. You know, the saying my dad had was the woods are my church.
Yeah.
And that has become my saying. I think it really epitomizes where we find spirituality, where we find what's left that's pure in America, all over the globe, with all the conflict we have, the divisiveness. We saw this through COVID, right? We saw so much fear, so much hatred of one another, just utter chaos. And I think it was a great testament, a great test in this country to see where we're lacking community. And the outdoors was such a healing thing through that, in that when depression, suicide, and lockdowns were going on, more people went outside. More people that were from urban areas that mostly walked concrete trails were now in the woods. They were on a lake shore, you know, they were wanting to fish, hunt, or just go out there and breathe. Yeah. And they were finding hope. You know, we had, I think, a 35 to 40% increase the year of lockdowns in hunter education, online classes being done, registered hunters, weapon purchases, people going to training, self-preparedness, the survival mindset. And I always look for the positive, right? A silver lining in an ugly situation. And one thing the COVID crap show showed us is that there's hope, you know, and Mother Nature. I mean, it was Mother Nature that was a spiritual healer for everybody. So I didn't realize how important that mantra would play in later in life, especially recently, but that came right from Dad and Grandpa. And yeah, that's where it all started.
Well, I mean, you've also been somebody who's been protecting quite literally in our waterways, our resources, and especially in California when you were over there as game warden. You faced such a unique set of challenges and situations, and I want to jump into that. Let's kind of talk about that day, you know, when you actually got the call that there was a waterway that wasn't running anymore, and kind of talk about this, because this is, I feel like, an integral step into what that next chapter of your career went with the marijuana and enforcement, or the Met, right? The marijuana yeah. enforcement team. And like, talk about what the kind of beginning stages of that, of when you're first learning about cartel growth in these public places and all of the destruction that that causes in so many different ways.
Yeah, it really was a big shift. It was a big career shift. I call it going from, you know, that's when I call it the darkness started, when you went from light to dark. And not to say that the first part of the career doing traditional hook and bullet, hunting, fishing, angling, stream bed alteration, hunter education tasks as a game warden was, you know, was any less serious, right? Or any less important than what we did on the med side, because some people, you know, confuse that, like, okay, or, you know, are you saying that, you know, this is all that's going on out there? And no, it's not,
right, not at all.
But, you know, when I started my career, the biggest thing we learned in the academy to make your name as a good game warden, a vetted game warden, was when you can go out and catch criminals that are deliberate, spotlighting, poaching deer at night under a light when they know it's illegal, maybe behind locked gates, maybe they're baiting animals in a state where you can't bait, whatever. When you start making cases like that, you kind of cut your teeth as a real operator, right? On the game warden front.
Yeah.
That's what I wanted to do. I wanted to get back in my hometown and go behind gates where it was really going on. Animal populations were being affected, not by the people making mistakes of, yeah, you know, I forgot my license, or I'm fishing with my daughter and I kept one fish that's half an inch too short. I mean, letter of the law versus spirit of the law. Those are not intentional poachers. Those are the folks that we warn. Those are our allies. Those are part, you know, everybody that's out there in the woods appreciating conservation is part of the Fair Green Line.
Sure.
We may be the enforcement branch, but you, what you're doing with this podcast, brother, you're an integral part of the Thin Green Line and absolutely essential. And I'm grateful for that. And one thing that was so cool about being a traditional game warden was that 95%+ of everybody I met were probably armed, right? But in a good way. They were not adversaries, they were allies. I would spend hours sometimes on shorelines or in deer camps talking with men and women and children that were happy to see me. Unlike most law enforcement, when they're knocking on your door for domestic violence or they're stopping a robbery in progress, that person isn't happy to see you and it might get very violent. And we had definitely some pretty hairy situations that could have gone deadly when I did that work. But when I found that first grow site and realized that we have embedded criminals from another country, part of, you know, criminal organizations, the technical term now is TCO, Transnational Criminal Organizations, but we'll, in layman's terms, we're talking about the cartels, whether the Mexican cartels not far from you across the border, or the Chinese, you know, crime groups, or whatever the case may be. We're talking about organized criminals armed, making billions of dollars of profits in black market cannabis and fentanyl and human trafficking and methamphetamine. I had no idea when we found that first grow site in 2004, and then when we raided it, saw what our new, you know, public enemy was, but these cartel growers armed with AK-47s, showing tactical awareness, embedded in parks with camouflage and field craft to the level that we would do in special operations and as hunters, that changed the game. And then obviously, after that case, that my first book, War in the Woods, I see behind you.
Yeah.
Books there. Thanks for putting those up. Wow. Oh,
of course.
It's a great array you have back there, man. You got Jim's book. I'm waiting to see Brother Jack's, but I'm sure there's some car back in there. Yeah.
Yep. Oh, yeah. No, it's, I think actually it might have gotten replaced in there, but there's all the other stuff over here of his, man.
Yeah.
He's coming on here in a few months to talk about the new book. Can't wait.
Love it. That is a great stack, man. Very, very cool.
Cheers.
But yeah, that 04 case, I had never seen anything like it. And as I described in the first book, it kind of changed my perception of how dangerous and how dark the work we as game wardens could potentially be doing. And I also saw a lot of deficiencies in how those situations were being handled. There was no concern for environmental reclamation, as we've talked about.
Right.
It was strictly raid these sites. Maybe you put a little effort into apprehending these bad guys, or you don't. You seldomly catch anybody. You might find a gun or two. You cut some plants that have EPA toxic poisons on them that you never want to see an illegal. You don't want to see that consumed by anybody in America. And you definitely don't want to confuse legitimate cannabis with this black market, toxically tainted stuff that the cartels are putting out there in the black market, and then destroy that and then leave the site. And as soon as we leave the site, what happens? All of that environmental destruction is there. The water diversions are still there. There's poisons leaching into the creek. There's this, you know, nerve agent, EPA banned carbofuran, you know, imported directly from Mexico because you can't use it or possess it or, you know, have it in America. That's all over a grow site. Well, clearly that's a major death to wildlife and waterways and wild lands well after we've done that raid. And then in 05, we had our first gunfight where my partner Warden was shot by an AK-47, almost died, you know, in my arms. I was providing trauma, returning fire on his, you know, on his aggressor. Two other sheriff deputies, brothers for life with the Santa Clara County Sheriff's, that we all worked together for the first time that day. They engaged a suspect that had a sawed-off shotgun trained on me and another game warden that we never saw. And I was literally, no exaggeration, half a second from not being on this conversation with you. had those guys not engaged that suspect behind cover. So the domino effect of that told me immediately that it was God's plan that we all do this. We were all men of faith on that mission, and we all realized, having not worked together, but having had enough similar training, having the right personalities together, and knowing that the bad guy got one shot off, non-fatally, thankfully, even though that round went through my partner both legs, and there he is bleeding out of four holes from an AK-47 7.62 round, and all the other gunfire came from us to stop the threat. And when that happened and we got out of that incident, I went, okay, I thanked the Lord. I prayed. I had gratitude. I, you know, walked out kissing the ground when I got off that helicopter line and realized I had a new group of brothers. And also realizing that we're not in Kansas anymore, Toto, for our older listeners, man, I was going a different direction. That career was going to go a different direction because now I kind of had I couldn't get this threat out of my head. You know, one, we were very angry. We were very, very angry that we had been ambushed and that one of ours had taken a hit. And it had been the first game warden in America, first law enforcement officer anywhere in America that had actually taken fire and been injured by a cartel grower. And it happened to be my partner and a game warden in the Silicon freaking Valley foothills in one of the most affluent, high-paced communities you're going to see on the globe. So it didn't add up. It didn't make any sense. Little did we know at the time, George, that was just the tip of the iceberg. And these cartels weren't only embedded all throughout our county of Santa Clara, they were all over California, they were embedded in 27 other states. I did not know at the time that it went beyond cannabis because now we got fentanyl, right? Which, as we know, is killing over 100,000 Americans a year, being done by the same factions, whether it's Sinaloa, Jalisco New Generation, whatever cartel's doing that, same ones doing the tainted weed, right? Methamphetamine, human trafficking, off the charts throughout the country, run by these same cartels we're fighting in the woods, and the child sex trafficking, which thankfully the Sound of Freedom film brought so much attention to make it so visceral for viewers and public members of America that hadn't really seen that firsthand. And, you know, a lot of people ask me, they go, well, I'm not a marijuana consumer. My kids are never going to touch it. We're never going to, you know, we're not going to be dabbling in the black market. And I don't live anywhere near a potential grow site. So why is this an issue for me? And exactly what we just discussed, I said, this is an issue for all of us. Every American, I feel, in my, you know, opinion on this thing is, this is should be a domestic priority for national security. The border is always an issue close to where you're at in Texas. Yeah. That, you know, we're going to get into congressional testimony in a bit, but that was a big issue of why I was there and what that same congressional committee is actually doing on the border as we speak, since I testified a couple months ago up there in D.C. But the bottom line is, this gets to, you know, a domestic eco-terrorism war, I think, with embedded criminals that are acting with impunity right now because they're just not being fought as a priority. And I know I'm preaching to the choir. You and I have had side conversations before this show. Senator Dan Crenshaw down in your great state is doing amazing work of highlighting the issues, showing what's not working at the border, and showing what as a national policy needs to change. But aside from that, the problem is still there. And it started for me on an environmental component of, what does this tainted cannabis production do to forests? What does it do to water? You know, what does it do lasting effects to communities? And when you look at these EPA banned poisons, no exaggeration, two tablespoons of this stuff dumped into a small creek can kill miles of every aquatic living in that channel. That's how nasty this stuff is. It's a nerve agent. It's an anticoagulant. You know, just a couple drops of it put in a tuna can as an animal or person detractant all around a grow site by the growers. You know, I've seen a 400-pound sow black bear lick that tuna can and get just a couple drops of that in her system. And 20 minutes later, she's laying over, frothy mouth, violent central nervous reaction, and she's dead. And her cub has died above her, exposed to the same poison. I mean, you're a hunter, brother, and you're doing so much good stuff on your ranch for conservation. And that, I mean, no, that just infuriates you like it does me, everybody else. Yeah. You know, the fellow conservationists we get to work with, like Jim Shockey and Jack Carr and Mike Ritland and even Joe Rogan, who's become, you know, verbally said, I'm part of the thin green line now. I'm aware. And that was the biggest blessing I heard on his show, is he's always been there, but he didn't know about this issue. So fast forward, we get to book number two, 10 years later, and we've done 3 years of television with National Geographic Channel on a number one hit show, Wild Justice, Game Warden reality show about us in California. NRA Patriot Profile documentaries, a ton of news articles. I've written articles. The first book has been out. And 10 years later, 15 years later, people are still going, I can't believe this is happening in our backyard, Lieutenant. How do I not know about this? George, right now I'm working with tier one writers that are conservationists in the 2A community on new articles on conservation and the hidden war that just learned about this incident literally and this whole reality 5 months ago. And they're in the industry of writing, like with my publishing, outside of my publishing, I'm at a different one. And when I look at that, I go, okay, we're underrepresenting this issue.
Yeah.
And we're all passionate about it, but you know, we're getting bombarded with stuff, proxy wars, you know, election problems, divisiveness,
distractions.
The distractions, man.
Yep.
And I think we get to a point where, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think everybody just gets a little overloaded with the negativity. And I get that. Again, I go to the silver lining. We've never been more effective as Americans than when we unify and agree to disagree. And what I'm finding now, and the one thing about this hidden war that we're fighting, is the left and the right, the pro-cannabis, anti-cannabis groups, animal rights preservationists, hunting conservationists, everybody agrees on this issue and everybody is outraged by it. Legal growers that I have done talks for before we regulated in California, you know, criminal outlaws basically previously to that meeting were as outraged by the way this stuff is getting done and the nastiness of this weed throughout America and wanting to join the fight. I could never imagine that people that are running from us under the old, you know, pre-regulation days and, you know, it's handcuffs first thing and now it's hugs and handshakes. Hey, I'll take that. I'll take that because we got to be in this fight together. Every American has to be involved and we got to put our political affiliations, our particular frame of reference, our particular lens aside and not judge and work together. And I'm actually seeing that through this particular issue as we get the message out like we're doing today, which I'm grateful for.
Cheers. Well, I'm so glad that you're here to talk about this. When I first learned about what was happening, I couldn't imagine. I was like, wow, okay, you know, it's this localized problem in California, perhaps. You got carbofuran and it's like killing all these animals. People having to wear special suits, let the area be clear for a certain amount of time after this has been applied before people can come in there and try to, you know, reclaim that site in any form or possibility. I know you talked at the very beginning that reclamation and remediation wasn't really there. And later on it came into play, but that it was just scary. And I mean, we talked about this, you know, maybe it was about a couple of years ago when I looked you up and gave you a phone call of me realizing that it's in my state of Texas too. And yeah, finding a site that, you know, we learned about in our local area in Central Texas. And these guys are diverting water from a creek bed into a 25-foot diameter pool. It's 5 foot high, taking all that water, you know, having all sorts of different battery powered, you know, trickle out, you know, sourcing for this water to have a 5,000 plant operation. And then the sheriff's like, oh yeah, we find these all the time on all these vacant lands or these corners of the pocket people can't get to. And they were, you know, it was just almost like laissez-faire to them. I was like, oh yeah, this happens all the time around here. Yeah, the cartel. And you can see all the different litter that they're leaving behind, all the different stuff. And those guys are walking in and I was asking him, I was like, what do you guys wear when you go on these sites? You know, are you kind of putting on something to respiration, you know, breathing? And he's like, oh no, it's no big deal. And I thought to myself, like, I don't know if you're really aware even that you guys are going to these sites, how toxic some of this stuff is.
Yeah,
because you have it in, you know, there's pictures in your book. I mean, you have all sorts of golden eagles and animals, deer, elk, whatever it may be that just come into contact. Like you said, the bear, they're dead. And imagine what that's doing in our waterways. Is that leaching into our water systems? People are, you know, I think when they realize the destruction and the crime, what that element's going through. I mean, you talked about going through areas, they had punji pits and like toe poppers. I mean, there was stuff set up to harm and they have that carbofuran all over it that could kill you almost instantly to keep people away from those sites. I mean, it's like you said, armed AK guys like around 24/7 to these growth sites and then they'd go out. I mean, this has been an issue that I didn't think that it was something that affected me. It was just a localized thing. And like you said, now it's probably 30 states have evidence of this type of thing happening all around the country. It's in your backyard, people. It really is right now.
Yeah, no, that's spot on, brother. You're right on the money with that. And the thing about it is it's beyond 30 states now because, you know, certain states that have regulated like California. And I always said, if you're going to regulate cannabis, please regulate it correctly.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
get these organic growers rewarded for doing a good job, get it in a legalized market, you know, make sure you break the back of the black market by not making this stuff too expensive, whatever you need to do.
Right.
And unfortunately, we did just the opposite. I had a little bit of pride that in my home state, previous home state of California, we're the weed state of the world, knowing that we grow weed for not only most of the country, but other countries as well, because we're just that Mediterranean climate, right? One of six in the world where you can grow from February to almost December on certain years outdoors, and then indoor hoop house, things like that. We're known for good wine in Cali, right? Definitely known for good weed as well. And I thought, this is going to be great. This is going to get all those illegal growers out of the dark. They're going to become our allies. And that's what started, that's what everybody tried to do in 2016 when this started. And of course, the legal growers realized the black market's killing us. The cartels are still running with impunity. We can't make our bottom end. We're going into the red. We're being undercut by taxation, by multiple permits needed. And I mean, I've literally watched some tier one conservation-oriented outdoor grow sites that were like going to a nursery that is exemplary, and they're done after 2 or 3 years because the whole system just is not protecting them to stay in a legal market. And that's the sadness of it. And when we don't continue to put penalties and stay stiff, you know, and I'm not talking about the legit cannabis grower at all. We are talking about cartel organizations, heavily, you know, funded, armed, structured, a great business model, very effective, of basically saying, oh, it's a misdemeanor in like the state of California. So if I have seven plants or 7,000, I might lose my plants if I'm raided, but am I going to go to jail if I don't have any other felonies there? Maybe not. It's just one of 20 operations I got going. Other states are experiencing this. Oklahoma, Oregon, Michigan, Maine now, all of these states that are regulating under the idea of getting revenue, and making a legal market easy to access. But once, you know, money gets involved and politics get involved, I always say once those two things become the goal, especially money making at the state, county, or federal level, especially on something like cannabis, then we have lost the game. We're going to incentivize a black market. Cartels are going to run even hotter. And they're actually increased since I retired. It's become more of a problem since 2016 when that law passed. When that law was sold as stopping and breaking the back of these cartels to get them out of the weed business. So we learned very quickly, and I use California as a ideal example of what we shouldn't do in other states. And something I talked about in Congress as well, regulation does matter. And we have to put an enforcement priority on it, penalties as well, education, environmental reclamation, and the environmental component has to be in that equation, because whether you're a conservationist or not, everybody loves fresh air. We love clean water. We love for our kids and grandkids, you know, to see what a black-tailed deer or a Texas mule deer looks like, or a hog or whatever. And it's just expanded to other states. And now in the states where it does become legal, they don't have to hide in the deep forests anymore like we primarily fought during my Met era. Now they're on rural tracts of land that you can drive to. They're in the boondocks, but they're not hidden in a deep canyon in a national forest. And it's hoop houses with thousands of plants. They've got all the EPA banned chemicals on them. And there are tens of thousands of these in most counties, say in California, that law enforcement is aggressively going after, and they're kind of playing whack-a-mole. They're barely putting a dent, you know? And that's that comes to regulation, that comes to policy. And I don't play the political game, but I can use what we know and what we've learned on the ground through blood, sweat, and tears, literally, you know, having major physical fisticuff altercations with these guys that don't want to give up. Our canines getting stabbed with blades coming out to stab us, gunfights where they want to, you know, basically dump an AK round on us and we have no choice but to defend ourselves. I mean, six gunfights before I retired, the first one we just talked about in book one, and there were more that continued. And through good training and great canine assets and being able to form a tactical unit dedicated to this is what's really kept us a lot safer for obvious reasons. And what a blessing it was to be part of that process and to see those men still out there every day, kind of, you know, hitting that whack-a-mole, but basically making a small effect dent, not because they're not putting the effort out, not because they're absolute warriors and committed and dedicated, but because the way the policies and the way the structure of, you know, the structure of the organization works when it comes to cannabis regs. So that's something we need to talk about. And I do talk about it at the end of Hidden War, especially the new edition you have in the second edition has all the mission chapters. Oh man, you got yours?
Oh yeah, I got multiples, man. I got multiples.
You're the man, dude. Thank you.
But they made great gifts.
Oh, I'm glad. And one of the cool things was with the second edition of that book, I'm tying into this because of the regulation change. Hidden War Edition 1 dropped April of 2019 at the NRA National Convention when Ollie North was the president there. He was my main endorser, the first reviewer of it. You know, really, as much as Ollie is a hunter and a conservationist and everything he's done in drug policy and everything in his military career, this blew him away. He's like, dude, I did not know game wardens were going up against us now. I did not know it was that pervasive. This is complete BS. I'm going to not only write a blurb, I want to launch this. So you got to have this published and like ready at NRA Annual. Well, that was April, George, of 2019. Our publishing date through Caribou, and that's Gun Digest Recoil. That's my publishing group. My publisher, Jim Schlender, great guy. He goes, we're not set to have these ready till like May. I go, well,
we're going to have to make a change.
Maybe we can revamp that. And sure enough, we did. And I cannot tell you what a cool launch it was at NRA Annual. And again, so many good people from all over the industry and civilians from all over Middle America that got the book and went, oh, Lieutenant, I had no idea. Are you kidding me? This is going on right now. I go, it's been going on for 20 years.
Yeah.
And it's just escalating. So Ollie was a big part of that. But then the book was starting to get out there, as you know, and we met through some of that in the podcast stuff. And then we got to selling out of the first edition and having to do a second printing. Jack goes through it, you know, with multiple printings with, you know, the Terminalist series.
Right.
But what I didn't want to do was just put another book out there of the same printing. I said, let's update it. You know, let's update trends. Let's update what's happened in the last 3.5 years. Let's polish up some things. Let's not take any of the old content out because that's critical. That's educational. It's exciting. And so I wrote a new introduction, as you know, that kind of brought you up to speed through COVID, through the border change, through the administrations, through lockdowns, what happened in America through divisiveness, how the cartels said. Cartels, the idea behind cartels as they operate, as you and I have discussed, is they thrive in a culture of chaos. That's what they know in Mexico. They're always at war. It's impoverished. It's rough down there. I've spent decades racing down on the Baja Peninsula to see those small towns where the cartels are now in. I mean, they're used to chaos. And when another country, like a first world country like us, under law and order and all the amenities and the luxuries we're blessed to have in this great nation, they're like, oh, this is easy. You know, I can get my product with demand anywhere I want. Law enforcement is taxed. COVID, there's defund the police. There's riots. There's all these issues coming down. So right now, that line is thin. That thin blue line, thin green line is so tenuous. It's like dental floss. It's about to snap. And that's what happened. The cartels got in our woods. They got on fentanyl. They got on human trafficking. And they continue to do that, both sides of the border. I wanted to tell that story. And then, you know, fellow friend, brother Jack Carr, said, absolutely, I'll write a new foreword for you. And he really nailed it after understanding what we were up against as he and I met. Yeah. And he was not aware to the level of these environmental poisons and what these guys are doing and to the level of embeddedness they had until he got into the first book. In the first edition of Hidden War when we met back several years ago. And so, again, thankful to all you guys for broadcasting it. But with that forward, my introduction, some polished points on the chapter, you're not just getting a reprint of the first edition. You're getting more material updated and all the old good stuff. And then I reread and we just launched it on Audible. Finally, we got that file up on Amazon to show that it's a different book. And that's a lot easier for people. And I don't know if you're noticing this, but you're a big book guy. And I love how much you're into good authors and reading. But we're finding that I like a print book always. I'll take a print book to read anywhere I can. But when I'm tight on confines, I'm on a Kindle or I'm on Audible. Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm listening to that Audible author, you know, because I can do a little couple of things. And what are we doing? We're listening to books and we're listening to podcasts, right?
Yep.
We're not watching a lot of news and we're not holding a book and reading a lot. So the Audible aspect of this has been cool because it's been able for guys like you and I and the fellow authors, you know, that you're working with to just get the word out.
Yeah.
And for me, it's always been about just absolutely grateful to have the opportunity to talk about something I and all of us, you and all your listeners and most Americans, again, regardless of where they sit on the conservation realm, are passionate about if they just know. And I've been fighting an uphill battle, and hence the second book was named Hidden War, because War in the Woods and Hidden War were 11 years apart, and it's still like, wow, we're still on this. Why is this happening? So that's kind of where the direction we're trying to go with the new book. before we go into a third book, because this stuff is so hot and proximate right now. And now I'm finding myself in the world of dealing with the fentanyl issue and discussing that, and human trafficking, especially understanding that, again, the cartels we fight in the woods are the same cartels. These are polycriminals. They're making billions, not millions, billions of black market dollars off all of us. And America, I literally call it the, it's basically, you know, the middleman, you know, and we're leveraged, our public, our wildlife, our children, they're basically the expendable, you know, for these criminals that honestly have no concern for environment. They have no concern for humanity. They're all about money in kind of a savage way. And a lot of that I go into in the book, and we're not making a judgment. We're just talking about the actions of how we are treated and how we are perceived by criminal organizations like this. And big changes have to happen. And I think hopefully through with what, you know, bipartisan congressional groups are doing now. As we talked a little bit before the show, I was invited to testify in Congress in October of last year. So just a couple months ago, first time, not first time to DC doing outreach, but first time doing that. So that was a little bit of a new deal. And I had about a week to put together a 12-page paper, a testimonial paper, and I was able to include photos of these new poisons, right, of the elements of the Chinese element now. Now we find that the Chinese organized crime groups that are coming up through the borders being trafficked by the cartels, obviously with easy border crossing under the current crap show down there, as you know.
Oh, yeah.
And we're getting these military-aged males, very intelligent, very physically capable, with passports from China in grow sites all over California and other states that are now taking over the indoor grow operation or the outdoor rural grow operations on private land, working hand in hand with the cartels for the Chinese providing precursor chemicals for meth, all the fentanyl chemicals, actually working hand in hand with the Sinaloa and other factions of cartels. With everybody getting rich, with all the money being laundered in place in America, both for the Chinese and for the Mexican groups. And how is that even possible? How can that happen in America with the amount of fentanyl deaths we have, with our children being targeted, with human trafficking off the rail charts, and this EPA banned poison toxic cannabis still getting out in the black market everywhere? How are we not looking at this as an internal war that we have to win for the sake of our people? I hope we're getting there. I hope we see a change here in the near future. I think if we don't, we're going to have some really, really, we don't have a lot of hope going after that. But one thing, George, when testifying with that committee is, even though it was bipartisan and it was, you know, a Republican committee chair, Chairman Gosar from Arizona, great guy that brought that committee together, everybody resonated with the message. And when I had 5 minutes to speak, and then they had 15 minutes between all of them to Q&A. And up on my YouTube channel, I have all that edit. Yep. So people can see exactly the questions that were asked and how unaware many of the congressmen that were from the border, focusing on the border and focusing on the cartel problem for the sake of all of us, wired right, how unaware they were of Silicon Valley, embedded in America, environmental, what are these EPA poisons? Whoa. I mean, this isn't just a border issue now, it's everywhere. And that's really what I was able to speak to. I'm very fortunate to do that. And response was very positive from both sides of the fence in that Natural Resources Committee in our U.S. Congress. So everything like that is an opportunity to spread information and hope you get to the right influential people that can change policy, that can change film. I think, you know, I'm a big film buff, like I'm a book buff, right? And again, I'm going to talk about, you know, movies that impact us, that drive us and make us emotional. They're not necessarily feel good all the time. They're not necessarily most comfortable, but they grab us. And I'm going to go back to Sound of Freedom.
Yep.
Sound of Freedom, when it dropped last July, and I remember it dropped on 4th of July when it finally made it. And you know, I know you know this, but for listeners and viewers that don't, 5 years after making that movie, they still couldn't get that thing distributed. Why was that? What does that say about how we're trying to hold back information, or we're trying to soft sell something, or we don't want to freak people out, or we don't want to expose something that heinous? Well, there's no way we're going to make a dent in it, brother, if we don't show how dirty and rotten this is. I mean, and again, I might have a bias from working with some very violent people and seeing the dark side of so much. But in general, when I saw that movie, and I worked these same cartels, and I've dealt with human trafficking integral to other cases, it hasn't been a focus. Definitely to the point of what Caviezel and what Tim Ballard were doing of rescuing these kids from these islands and everything else, I was in tears. I was grabbing the armrest of that recliner chair so hard, I probably tore my nails off, and I was just like the emotional roller coaster. I said, okay, I know this, it's just not public, and this is making me want to go back in an organization. And if I have time, I want to jump on a 501(c) bus and go rescue children or be part of it. And I'm going to do what I can to help that side of it. But the point of it is, if it's affecting me like that, Americans that watch this, they're going to be shocked. And they're going to say, this is in my backyard. And that's exactly what that movie did, thank heaven, when it went mainstream and blew up to a bestseller and went over some other commercial movies. And now it's going international. And that's why I think the visual medium, you just can't get to people faster and in a better way, whether it's through a TV series. And I'll take Jack and Terminal List and you know, the new Ben Edwards prequel that's coming out.
Yep.
I mean, fictional. But it's showing a lot of patriotic things. It's showing a lot of good stuff. Terminal List, because Chris Pratt himself is an A-list actor playing James Reese, is a conservationist. Jack, of course, is a fellow hunter and conservationist. And to see Chris dabbling in those scenes in the first series of Terminal List was just magic, man. I knew it was coming. Jack and I had talked in our different dealings, but I went, I want to see Chris pull that off. And it just gives me the chills thinking about it. But that had such a popularity and so many people viewed that, and it was so quote unquote unwoke, and it was so patriotic, and it was so anti-establishment of the previous Hollywood norm for success. It kind of changed the way Americans are looking at their information. And I think we're seeing a little more patriotism in it to show that the Maverick Top Guns can blow it up and show patriotism in a good light. Mm-hmm. You know, men can be men, women can be women. Heroes don't always wear capes. You know, it's all of us in this mix doing good things. So I think that's the way to do it. We do it with the books, we do it with the audibles, and we do it with film and scripted series. And we need more of that. And then I think we'll get enough people pissed off and, you know, infuriated and heartbroken. I mean, dude, that movie rocked me, and it rocked my family when everybody watched. I was like, wow, that's going to shake some, that's going to shake some trees now that it has. I mean, it is, you know, you've seen the social media responses from big players, how critical this human trafficking thing is. And if everybody makes a connection to weed, to fentanyl, to meth, to human trafficking, to our children, I don't know one American, you know, regardless of where you sit in this nation, that wouldn't say, oh yeah, I want to know, I want to be educated. I want response. I want a team. I want to make sure my kids are protected. I want it a national priority, and it needs to be. And I think we're going in that direction. I have hope for it.
I do too, man. I mean, we've talked about this too. We have in our family, two ranches in our family on either side, my mom and my dad's side. On my mom's side, we have it right about 30 miles from the border. Very close. And it is insane how many people are coming through. And, you know, when I was growing up, I'd see families, you know, you'd see like a grandfather is like one shoe's blown out and he's coming up and he's hungry and thirsty. And it's like, yeah, we're going to keep you alive while you're walking through. You're trying to make a better life for your family. God bless you. I get it. You know, we're all coming from someone else unless we're Native American Indians, right? It's a melting pot, and
we're all immigrants, man.
Exactly. Exactly. There's a lyric by Jack White, you know, who's what and who's who, you should kick yourself out. You're an immigrant too. Like in this response, everyone's like, we can't let them here. It's like, now that you're here, you shut the gate. But you have to do it in a systematic way that doesn't put pressures on those systems. You can't let certain types of behavior and criminal activity in, and we're endorsing that. Like you're talking about, like, I remember you were mentioning how, like, you know, one time they like flood this one particular area, all the response comes in there to try to slow down that area. Well, all they're doing is just that next seepage of spots. They're throwing through people through there. And I've had, you know, Border Patrol, game wardens I've talked to in South Texas where they're saying, last week wasn't bad. They're running in groups of 100. You know, sometimes we're seeing like 200. I was like, that's good. But it's all military age men. And occasionally we've seen on our game trail cameras and stuff that if there is a female, usually she has her head down and there's someone with their hand on her shoulder walking her through the brush. You can tell she doesn't want to be there. You know for a fact that it's like, it's not these families that you're seeing come across anymore. It's a whole different thing. We've got guys with backpacks that are threatening to kill people who are working on our place in Spanish to each other. He was married to a Mexican woman. He knew what he was saying. He's like, he's this white guy. He's like, hey, by the way, you know, I'm armed and you're not going to take me and you're not going to take my truck. And it's like, they are by any means necessary. Who knows what they got in their backpack? That could be $20 million worth of fentanyl between them. And if they get caught, their family members are going down. They're enslaved in that traffic too. They might not even want to be there as mules, but they're having to be, otherwise their families are being killed. It's a ruthless thing that's happening with the cartel in every single element. And I couldn't be more disgusted and sad at what we're seeing on a day-to-day basis, but at the same side, you know, there's two sides of every coin. I couldn't be more happy that there's people like you that are shining a spotlight on this, because, you know, that darkness is out there, but until we shine the light on it, do we not need, that's when we see what we need to fix. And this is something that is across the entire country in different elements. Like you said, it started out maybe in your awareness of, you know, this illegal growth and the environmental and it impacts and that it's happening. And then, oh my gosh, the criminal impacts. And then we're seeing this in fentanyl, meth, all the different human struggling. And like, you know, these are, again, I'm not trying to just reiterate everything you say, but I just see it. And I am wanting to make sure that people are aware and that they can do something about it. And I'm glad that, you know, congressmen and women who didn't even realize the levels of this issue are now being, it's brought to their attention. Hopefully we can see change. And I guess that was kind of a question I wanted to ask you, is like, what, aside from maybe like teams that are being formed to unilaterally fight this, what are you seeing as some stepping stones? You can say, this is successful. We're making some grounds here. Or is that something that you can say?
Yeah, no, I can talk about it. And to get back to what you were experiencing, what I like about this is coming from you on the border right now as we speak. This is on your ranches. And I, you know, in my pilot film, the Thin Green Line film series that I run for Recoil, I know you've seen that.
Yep.
We were on that. I was on the Southwest Texas-Mexican border for the first time in my life. And it was mind-blowing to see the track. And this is when we had border protection. This was right before pandemic lockdowns, right before the change of administration. And now being down there and seeing what you guys are experiencing now, it's, you know, tenfold what it was. And that's probably a conservative. But showing that it's happening down there where you're seeing it, and I'm up here in Montana and we're seeing the human trafficking, fentanyl, meth are off the hook here in, you know, wilderness country that you would not think of a community necessarily be involved in that, plus California. It just reiterates, it's all of our problem, right, brother? It's all of us. And what I see happening is outreach and education more than anything, and programs to educate the masses on what we're dealing with. I'm seeing fentanyl warning signs up here in northwestern Montana. I'm seeing them all over California. I'm seeing in other states on
billboards.
They're everywhere. You know, by the way, this is what fentanyl can do. This is the, you know, what you need to have for an antidote. But, you know, the fentanyl, you know, protection kits now that are being put in schools. Human trafficking, these are the signs to look for. You know, if a person is making these movements, all those little, you know, target indicators, we call it, right? Those giveaways. Kids and families should be educated on that. If you're, you know, out of view of your child and you don't have a weapon or a CCW, you're not capable of defending life when you get an aggressor coming in to, you know, kidnap for trafficking purposes or whatever the case may be, there needs to be some change to that. I think good policy, sensible policy on every level. And, you know, obviously my forte on what works and doesn't work is in cannabis, but fentanyl isn't any different. You know, how you're going to structure that, how you're going to attack it, methamphetamine, trafficking crimes, all of those. Obviously, those are, you know, you get your felonies, you're going to get some stronger convictions. It's pretty much a slam dunk the way they're scheduled. But I mean, some of these states that are saying, you know, was it Oregon, I believe, that, you know, opened all legality to all drugs and decriminalized meth and fentanyl and heroin. And they're having another, you know, it's a train wreck. I mean, a full on, you know, bullet car derailment in that state. And they're going, what were we thinking? Well, you know what? I don't know what you were thinking. And I'm never going to disparage an independent opinion because I don't want to generate any more divisiveness than we have in this country because it's going to destroy us.
Yep.
But I want to just say common sense, good policy, and getting our policymakers fully aware. And I go back to congressional testimony of talking to open-minded, you know, Republicans and Democrats, and even though they don't get along all the time, and even though there's some, you know, they're headbutting like crazy, like never before in our Congress now, in our Senate, we see it. It is disheartening. But what I saw that day was kind of a light bulb go off. And now that same congressional committee has literally been on the border doing subcommittee work and touring and seeing every aspect of what's going on for the last month. And, you know, on different news channels, I'm seeing the same congressman and women that I know now that we presented to that ran that first committee we did 2 months ago. And they're going down there and they're able to call BS on what they might be sold from a bad media source because they know the background, they know the impacts where this stuff is going deeper into the country and on an environmental standpoint and just on a public safety standpoint. So it comes honestly from just good policy and prioritization. Yeah. Prioritization. Take policy and prioritize it. Put it in the top 10. Dan Crenshaw talks perfectly about this all the time. The war with the cartels has to be a number one priority, like anything we would do from an attack from a foreign invader. There's no other logical way to stop it. And this can't just be a law enforcement or military response, I think, George. I think you've got to look at everything. The education, the counseling, rehab centers, family counseling, because these drugs in one family tear apart, you know, they can tear apart a generation, if not more, when you have a fentanyl death. And we're having fentanyl deaths in my old stomping grounds of the Silicon Valley in affluent communities of a valedictorian high school senior that's slated to go to a great school. She's got a volleyball scholarship. She plays an instrument in band. She's, you know, over a 4.0 student, and she ends up taking a fentanyl pill by mistake from a friend just as a painkiller from, not because she's trying to get high, because she's just got, an inflamed, swollen meniscus, let's say, because she's pounding hard as an athlete. Goes into her bedroom to study and go to sleep, and the next morning, mom can't wake her up. That happened a couple months ago to a very close friend of mine's family member. And, you know, everyone's that I know somebody that experienced a fentanyl death. If you're in California and you live in a rural community around cartel, whether it's Chinese, Mexican, or whatever, weed, everybody has a story of gunfire, of, you know, their dogs being attacked, guard dogs attacking them from other farms, their kids at risk, major other criminals, human trafficking going on in these grow sites. So awareness first, and then attack it as a national priority. And that's how we make a change. I think we're in baby steps, honestly, because the information is now there. Obviously, yeah. What we're talking about today isn't new information. The fentanyl issue now is red hot after 5 years. The human trafficking issue couldn't be a hotter button item because of like Sound of Freedom. And now awareness that there's all these human trafficking, really what I call tactical law enforcement units throughout America doing amazing work. And they've been doing amazing work for a decade or more, but now all of a sudden it's, yeah, we need more of this because now people are seeing it. So this awareness is the first sensible policy and it somehow, some way, and I don't honestly know if this is even possible. We got to get people at the political level in our House and our Senate agreeing to disagree and coming together for good policy. And something I do know that is happening right now that I can talk about is one of the reasons that congressional committee is down on the border is a multitude of other border control bills are coming up. And they're being more protective of America, I think. They're being more sensible based on these experts that are coming in to testify in congressional hearings. And one thing I'm seeing is more and more bills are coming up, and we're getting asked to go back and do more of this education, which means different congressional committees, different congressmen, different senators are starting to become aware. That's showing me that somehow, some way, we're getting past that ugly divisiveness by the parties, and we're going to get somewhere to say, hey, we can agree to disagree, and we can fight about this other issue later, but you know what? Our border is flooded, the environmental impacts that are coming, the nastiness of criminality that's coming across, what you're experiencing as a Texas rancher, brother. I mean,
crash everywhere.
Dude, there's cracks everywhere. You hit it. That's the tip of the spear right there is Texas and any border state. And then we just see, we see the shit show that follows, yep. You know, to put it mildly. That's where it has to start. And I'm optimistic. And I think a lot will depend on what happens in November this year.
Yeah, no, I think that's going to
really do.
It seems like that topic is being brought up more and more, and that it's almost like a forced issue that was just kind of swept under the rug before. I mean, yes. It's like I'll call Border Patrol and we'll be like, hey, because we coordinate with them and stuff. And like, I mean, you know me, I'm fairly involved with, you know, in law enforcement knowledge and stuff. So I'm talking to these guys and hey, you know, if you guys want to come on by, you know, grab a sandwich or whatever. Maybe we got some barbecue on if we're at the ranch. And like, seriously, like I want to sit down. Like, what are you guys facing on a day to day? And there's times where he's like, hey, just so you know, for the next week, there's no one in your area. And I'm like, wait, one of the head spots of Border Patrol, like one of their main centralized units is just down the road. And I'm like, I know how many people work there. And I'm talking to him and he's like, yeah, no one's in the field. We are all over in Eagle Pass right now. We have 10,000 right. people a day coming. We yep. just for the next week, if anything happens, be mindful, keep your yeah. head on a swivel and stay protected and make sure you keep one in the chamber in case something ever happens, because we're seeing yeah. numbers and we're seeing a lot of violent offenders come through right now. And I'm like, what? Like it just the sheer amazingness of like how a whole area in this county is not being serviced by our Border Patrol because of how overrun they are, how few dollars are being sent that way to really protect our border, how easy it is for people to come across. I mean, we're finding backpacks left and right. And for the most of the people that are coming, and I mean, it's, I think the number that maybe you had said it, it's like $33 million a week is being yeah. transferred through the cartel by just human yeah. struggling. And even they're just bringing regular people coming across to try to make a better life, that money, the $6,000 to $7,000 per person was a number I heard of what they're paying to get across. And maybe you can verify that or not, but the idea of like how much is coming through, they're coming across full backpacks with the clothes, change clothes, and just walk into the town. And yep. they have a network there to be able to take them out to major cities. I have friends in Denver who are talking about how overrun they are and how they just, there's things are bursting at the seams. And unless you really are in a community that sees it firsthand, you don't know. I mean, we can't keep up with just the trash on our property, just the people coming across, and that's just people. And then you talk about like the environmental impacts. That's not as much in our area in South Texas, but in Central Texas, that illegal grow stuff, all the stuff that was through there. I'm like, I don't know what our waterways are polluted with right now. I don't know what's
right,
but I know that left and right, there's more issues that are compounding, and we see it in Texas a lot more than maybe other states. That, you know, some folks up in New England, my friends are like, what's it like down there? And like, here's what it's really like. I don't know what you're getting reported, but it's an issue. You know, we have hundreds of people coming across our, you know, property on a daily basis. And you know that they're all not there with the right minds. You got these guys with the big old backpacks. You know, they're not carrying diapers, man. Yeah. You know, it's not goodwill. So yeah, no, I mean, you know, we could talk to a red in the face about this, but I wanted to kind of pivot in two directions. One, I heard you mention third book. Is there anything that's coming in that you can talk about that at this point? Or is that just kind of something you're beginning to work on? Or is there an avenue of interest that you want to kind of have a spotlight on for that third book? Or is this just kind of at the very beginning stages of?
It's beginning stages. What I can say at this point is the discussions I'm having with my great publishing team is we're going to stay on some of these issues that I'm still continuing to fight because they're relevant. But let's just say there's a lot of traditional work from the past that paved the way for the future, and some cases no one's heard publicly that are mind-blowing that really led to a lot of stuff we're doing here. And one thing I can say, there's going to be some really sinister twist to another faction of West Game Wardens get involved in. I'm not going to give away what that is, but it does have a lot to do with what we're discussing today.
Yeah.
And I know that's really general, and that's yeah. all I can say at this point, because
that's fair.
But that, and I want to go, I definitely want, it will stay nonfiction. I've had a lot of fellow authors and friends go, hey, are you ever going to dive into like CJ Box, who does the Joe Pickett series. He's a good friend. He's been on our Wardens Watch podcast twice now. You know, he catalyzed the Joe Pickett TV series and went two seasons on Paramount. Thankfully they got something about Game Wardens on, you know, a scripted somewhere. But CJ just keeps mixing it up in his books, and he can do that fictionally. And I've had a lot of, you know, CJ included, does, you know, and these guys say, hey, would you go and do something fictional? Eventually that'll probably happen, but there's still a lot of non-fictional stuff that I think will be really beneficial, not only from the Thin Green Line perspective, but just from domestic security, you know, love for the outdoors, and bringing kind of conservation in as some of the healing elements that we talk about today. From experiences that go, you know, way before and up through the COVID pandemic and that mess. So we're dabbling in areas like that. And I'll have some stuff in the not too distant future on that. Yeah.
Good. Well, I look forward to it. Whenever that's about to come out, we'll have to have you back on, kind of announce
Heck
it as
yeah,
well.
Man. Yeah.
And you know,
be honored.
You also are talking a lot. I mean, let's talk about your podcasts that you've run and Warden's Watch, Thin Green Line. Let's talk a little bit about what you've done. And are you still very active with that? What is it that you're kind of putting the focus on? I know you've done some filming and things. So what's in your day to day? And can you maybe just kind of give people, if they haven't listened to it, what they come to expect and where they can tune into that?
Yeah, for sure. I co-host Warden's Watch podcast. The founding member of that is Wayne Saunders, lieutenant, good guy out of at New Hampshire. He started Warden's Watch right after retirement, before COVID started, just to have a game warden specific show to tell game warden stories. Because again, the public loves game warden stories. Everybody loves game wardens. We're pretty unified, you know, because we're kind of that, you know, that animal cop that everybody digs. And Wayne had been a Northwoods Law alumni. He had been on that show, on Animal Planet. I was a Wild Justice guy with Nat Geo on our California show. And we met at, it was right after I retired, right after the first edition Hidden War dropped. And I was actually giving a talk to just a group of chiefs of all the different states, fish and game warden chiefs. And Wayne happened to be there with International Wildlife Crime Stoppers with his booth. I set up my book booth. I'm going to go speak to the chiefs on the Hidden War issue, because I have a pretty dynamic PowerPoint presentation for agencies or civilian groups that want to see this.
Sure.
I go in a little deeper than the book. I have ones just for, you know, law enforcement groups that go into the trends, the safety protocol, the officer-involved shooting debriefs, because I debrief about four of the six OISs or gunfights we've been in for training value, lessons learned, and how they went. But I can get into the weeds really, really deep, you know, with LE groups. And I was basically doing that for this chief's group. And then Wayne had me interviewed as a guest on Warden's Watch that day. I didn't even know about Warden's Watch. And we loved talking. It got into the whole Hidden War issue, which he did not deal with in New Hampshire. And then a couple of weeks later, we started talking. He goes, man, it'd be really cool if, how'd you feel about co-hosting? Because you got the whole West Coast and, you know, you're national now and the reach is growing. And, you know, you got Rogan and Ritland and Jack and everybody, you know, working
Ranella,
together on this stuff.
All the R's.
It's all the R's. All the R's. Steven and his meat eater crew. And I said, yeah, let's try this out. So we just started through COVID co-hosting. And honestly, I'm way too underwater with other things to co-host every Warden's Watch episode. Because Wayne will do those in real time on the East Coast. He'll do it at a trade show or he'll do it remotely. But I will jump on as many of those as I can. Yeah. We always do Thin Green Line together because we kind of started that one together in COVID, thinking, you know what? We're sitting around in lockdown. We're not twiddling our thumbs, but we have a lot of frustration with the issues going on. Why don't we start something called the Thin Green Line that we can bring in non-game wardens? We can bring in any conservationist we want. Jack Carr was one of our first guests. Mm-hmm. You know, we can bring in Ed Calderon. We can bring in Oliver North, who doesn't do podcasts. And I got Colonel North on, and we had longer than he's ever talked on a podcast, one of the greatest conversations ever.
Yes.
Barry Kirch, you know, my friend from the band Shinedown I'm close to. He's a drummer, but he's a conservationist. He has a deer lease. You know, he's an outdoor culinary cook. I mean, he's completely... That band is wired right when it comes to love for the outdoors and wildlands. I didn't know that. So we've had a lot of really good guests. We've been able to mix it up. We can have musicians. We can have athletes. We can have actors. We can have novelists, you know, people like that. We can have biologists. We can have, you know, SEAL team guys. We can have other military factions. And we've done that. And that's where Thin Green Line goes. And we usually put out about one episode a month with us. It's not so much quantity, but quality.
Right.
Finding the right guests and then getting our schedules to align. We've got some really cool ones dropping that we just put in the can. And basically, if you just go to wardenswatch.com or you look it up on Apple, Spotify, we're on every platform. It's free to listen to. We have a Patreon type deal if you want to see video content or get, you know, behind the scenes footage. We have the triple threat pack option where you get a Hidden War book personalized. You get one of my Trailblazer folders, one of the blades that I know you're really familiar with.
It's my EDC, man.
I know, man. I'm honored.
Every day.
And not just you. You pushed them out into the community. You got a little battle contingent. So I got to say thanks. Big
you're
time.
Welcome. Well, we go to the ranch, man, and there's four dudes there who've got the same knife. So one of my buddies, Matthew Mitchell, he's got the MM on his. This one's marked over here to make sure. I'm telling you, man, it's the best thing. I was a knife lover, and I got two. It's like in case I leave one in the truck, I got another one, man. They are wonderful knives. Well, let's jump into that for a second too, man. Let's talk about V knives and about the Trailblazer and exactly what's going on. I know there's some new knives that came out recently. Why don't you just lay it out for folks where they can go and learn more about it? And, you know, I think I'll just kind of preface this with the idea. It's like you designed that knife with your buddy based on all the things that you wish you could have in one knife when you were on the force, yeah. Correct?
That's the best way to say it. And I got to give a big shout out to Mike Bellekamp, who's the founder, CEO of V-Knives. And, you know, Mikey's been in the game since, you know, running the Spyderco factory in Golden, Colorado in his 20s, way back when I started my career in the early 90s. We happened to get, you know, introduced at the perfect time, didn't know anything about each other, literally 7 days after I retired from operations at the end of 2018, before Christmas. He's a rock and roll guitar player, metal guy, writing an album right now, been in bands growing up. I got to talk about that because you're a music guy too. Mm-hmm. You were quite the shredder yourself. Yeah, oh, I've been following you, brother. That's awesome, George. But the thing was, when Mike and I hit it off, he goes, dude, I had no idea about you game wardens doing this. I'm all about the thin green line. And let's design your signature knife. I'm like, okay, let's do this. I mean, I haven't designed a knife before. I've been a knife guy. I've carried like 30 different blades. You know, I probably have
100
different blades. Yeah. Yeah. Not all at the same time, but yeah, he took my initial design that had the glass breaker, that had the seatbelt harness cutter, that had a drop point blade that's easy to deploy fast, yet it's not a switchblade, so it's legal in all the states, but it's a drop point so you can skin gut and do field craft, but you can also fight or defend if you need to. Lanyard loop, all those things you need on a folder, right? So I have the original draft is on, you know, sketch paper with a sketch pencil that I can kind of move around like an art piece. And it's a very robust looking drawing. I'll just say that. Sometime I'll share it. And actually, Mike just gave me back the original drawing that's now in my fire safe because we've got this chronology of designing these blades together. And the thing that was just great is he looked at it and goes, okay, I see where you're going with this. He goes, that is a really, really hardy, robust Studebaker. Let's put some Ferrari into it. I went... And, you know, and he's a rock and roll guy, and V-Knives just has a great, great edge with good quality. I'm like, I like this guy already. He's a big Rush fan. He knew Rush. I'm a Rush fan, very influential growing up, but all the other metal bands that we grew up in were of that same generation like you. So we ended up talking music and playing guitars more, and me listening to him shred the first meeting than we ever did anything on the CAD drafter. And then we finally designed the knife on the second meeting, and that's what the Trailblazer that you carry has morphed into. And then 2 years later, last winter, actually the winter before last, over New Year's weekend, hanging out here in Montana, he was spending some time. And, he, you know, we had been talking about a fixed blade series, specifically a fixed blade survival blade that you can hunt, fish, survive, chop, cut, build lean-tos with, whatever. And that was the main thing a lot of my people wanted. They said, hey, are you going to do a fixed blade line? I said, eventually, yes. Well, now we're finally designing it. But in the process of designing that, Mike also said, hey, I'm getting a lot of, you know, I'm getting a lot of inquiries about a small fixed blade, a possibles go-to backup knife for law enforcement and military. And ironically, I had been getting those same questions, but I said, we're probably only going to do one because I don't want, you know, I don't want to overtax the system. I mean, we have a whole, you know, a big lineage of new products coming out. And I didn't feel very, I thought that would be a little too much in the Trailblazer for the moment. But Mike said, no, I think we ought to go for it now. We should do two knives. And so that's how the Trailblazer full-size fixed. And then the Delta blade came out. And the Delta is just that little go-to, you know, drop point fixed blade with the removable thin green line scale handles, skeletonized underneath. It's in a Kydex sheath. It's become my carry field knife for hunting especially. But it, you know, put it on your short haul harness. If you're an operator and you got to cut yourself out of a helicopter harness or cut yourself from a line, Swiftwater Rescue, you name it. I mean, it's just a good little fixed blade. And the full size Trailblazer is a 5-inch blade, robust, you know, the tang on the back is a 1/4-inch nut driver for the glass breaker. And you've got a built-in sharpener in the sheath. I mean, Mike thinks of stuff like that that other companies don't do. And on a fixed blade, you can sharpen every blade you have from any manufacturer, as long as you have that fixed blade sheath somewhere close. So they've been real popular, man. We're sold out of most everything for first run. We're going to be going into our third run of Trailblazer folders that we're on the third year of those. And we're almost sold out of the line of fixed blades. I think I'm down to two Deltas, and they're gone. And we made the mistake of only making 1,000 of those blades. Our distributors got 70% of them. And between what I got from the company from my side of the royalties and what Mike's selling out of our retail store and through our factory, I can't get any more Deltas for another year. And I have a handful left. And I'm going, oh, man. So we're definitely going to make more next time. But just a real right-minded company, a true friend and brother. I mentioned his album because I know we got the music and we're going to talk about music. Yep. But he told me years ago, he said, I've been in bands off and on for a lot of years, but it's been my dream, my bucket list. By the time I'm 50, I need to make a metal album of original stuff that I'm going to write, bring a band together and tour with this thing. And he goes, and what I'm thinking is I want you to write, co-write the lyrics with me for a song called Hidden War, and we'll write the music. And then we'll make that kind of probably the first single we release because we want to get that message out. And I got to sing in the studio with him a month and a half ago to do the backing vocals and harmonies on a song that he wrote the music for, that we wrote the lyrics for together. And it's such a treat, man. It's an honor, and it is badass. I teased it a month or so ago. It's almost it's all mixed. It's going to drop soon. You'll definitely be in that loop. People have access to it. I'll put up the lyrics, and people can see what it's about. But that's been a fun project, you know, sharing the music. The other songs on the album that I've heard so far, because about six of the 12 that are written and produced are mind-blowingly cool. You know, Cavalcade, that goes back to our forces storming the beaches of Normandy and what the Nazi regime personified, and how it's written musically and how it's written lyrically. You know that as a musician. When you find the music to match your lyrics and you set that emotional tone, you got a hit on your hands. If they just completely symbiotically are synonymous, you know? And that's what he did with Hidden War. It's what he did with Cavalcade. It's what he did with Drift and Scarecrow. And I'm only throwing out a couple names of this album, but it's really good stuff. There's going to be some videos to it. There's going to be a Hidden War video to the Hidden War song that's going to show the stuff that we're fighting, that's going to show the poisons, that's going to show what America is facing. And I think, you know, we talked about cinema and we talked about TV. Music gets to people. In the band I'm in right now, Area 56, our little, you know, classic rock cover band up here in Northwest Montana, our bassist Seth, fantastic bassist, completely different politically backgrounds, didn't know about this issue. All the guys got books when I met them from the first edition of Hidden War they got way back in the day, and now second edition. And it's just neat seeing musicians gravitate to doing songs that are going to have a little bit deeper meaning than just a feel good, hard rock ballad, you know, soft, slow song dance, whatever you're looking for. I like something that hits hard, and it hits hard either emotionally in a sensitive way, or it hits hard emotionally in a passionate, oh man, we got to change something, you know? And I can't tell you how much positives we're getting from, you know, all the critiques that we're having out early, all the critics for like Hidden War and Cavalcade and things like that. But music is magic, man. And that's been a real sidebar for me. That's been absolutely a blessing and a way to get out of all the darkness of the law enforcement job I did for so long. And even to be constantly reminded of it when we do stuff like this, because it didn't end for me in retirement. Obviously the landscape got a lot bigger for me from the standpoint of outreach. And now, you know, the pen has become mightier than the sword. I'm not, you know, pushing a, you know, piston-driven 308 POF with my boys anymore, and I miss them every day.
Sure.
But I know being able to talk freely, be able to put the message out, being able not to disparage anybody, disparage no state, disparage no, you know, political realm, let people learn for themselves, talk about what's really going on the ground. And when I was employed and an operator, there's no way I could have done this second book. There's no way I could have been on these podcasts. There's no way I could have hosted a podcast. There's no way I could have made a feature film or a documentary, the other things that are in the works. And that's a very, very fortunate place to be. But I don't take it lightly. You know, I don't take it lightly. And sometimes it gets a little maniacal. So when I can go rock out, and in fact, later on, you'll appreciate this, man.
Yep.
So we gigged up until our 2023 gig season went right up to a Halloween gig at a local venue that we're going to play four times this year. Just a great spot in Troy, Montana. Normally we do a New Year's Eve gig.
Uh-huh.
And this year, the host venue that we normally do a New Year's Eve gig had to close down for a rebuild and a remodel and couldn't, you know, host a big party because we get a pretty good crowd. So we didn't have a New Year's Eve gig. So we disbanded after an amazing final gig on October 26th, late Saturday night. And I had not seen my band brothers here at home until this last Saturday for our first Woodshed season. And we did that first Woodshed rehearsal and in Woodshed, like, you know, being in a rock and roll band, I mean, we play 45 songs a night, and they're from all over the board. You know, we play a 4-hour set. Sometimes we end up staying longer into a quasi fifth set. It's ridiculous. And every year we want to keep it fresh. So we all get like a pick or two of like, what's the go-to dream song you want to play? Even if it's not a top 100 Billboard classic rock song, play something fresh. You know, for me, it was Shine Down Daylight last year. Daylight was such a pivotal song when I was with the boys and saw them play it live last April in Spokane at their, when they launched their arena tour. I went, you know, for a band that's playing classics from Ozzy to Blue Oyster Cult to Rush, you know, to Metallica to, you know, Three Doors Down to Collective Soul. And I'm just scratching, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Those are just some of the.
Yeah, you mentioned.
Dozens and dozens.
Yeah, you mentioned Jack. I mean, we do, you know, Seven Nation Army. I mean, yep, we do a ton of stuff. But a song like you bring in something that's so new and so fresh and so maybe a sensitive side, and the crowd loved it. And we made a really unique version because we don't have a classic piano player in the band. I'm a keyboard guy, but I'm not going to play like Eric Bass does, who wrote that song, you know, the Miracle Man there. But we actually took the guitars and the bass and recreated our bassist and lead guitar player are playing the piano part. Josh is covering Barry's drum part. I'm singing Brett's vocals. And we're doing it all in a particular key where it's kind of a stripped down version, sort of, but still has a rock element. And it's gone over really well. We're on 8 new songs. We went through 4 of them this last weekend and we got darn near ready to perform them in one rehearsal. Nice. That's how solid these guys are. We all get it. And like, oh wow, he wants another Rush song. I want to do a Slayer song. Okay. We're going to compromise here. So yeah, it's been good. It's been good. And we're the rehearsals are starting. We're playing 8 shows for sure this year. We're getting asked to do more. Like you being so busy with ranch and farm and everything you got going with your projects, we could do 20 plus gigs a year. We get that many inquiries up here and none of us have the bandwidth for it. And I'm probably worst because I'm not here at home enough, right? Because I'm on the road doing what we're doing. And that's always the priority. But, you know, this is coming out in our music. And my band brothers, man, Mike, Josh, and Seth are just fantastic true brothers to realize, hey, we really believe in your message. We know you're going to be gone a lot. We love what you're doing. And whatever we can do to, you know, kind of support that in our music and you know, with crowds. And we have a lot of fun on stage. And it's been a real good journey. Been a lot of fun.
No, it's amazing, man. You guys are so much fun. I definitely encourage everyone to go check it out. There's some great videos you posted. Maybe we can highlight a couple here and send some links down below on that because you guys are fun, man. They're a great band. All of you musicianship, it's really great to see. I always kind of joke about this too, is that one of these days, all of us are going to form like some super group tour thing or something like that. You know, it's like all the different people I meet throughout, you know, chatting and you find out someone so is a musician, plays with this little cover band, or oh, they sit in with this group over here, you know, whatever it may be, whether it's just singing or harmonica, or, you know, there's tons of musicians that are playing out there and it's neat to have that as a medium of a message. And like you said, too, a good release too. So, I mean, I was just going to, before we dive into the next, you know, I want to talk about the documentary full length things you're mentioning there a second ago, but I wanted to kind of find out when you first started playing in bands. Like, when does that, high school thing or is it like, you know, or like college years, or when did you kind of jump in and find this as a, an element of your life that you've been able to keep going for so long?
You know what, man, that's a question that's never been asked and bear with me. It's going to be a little long winded story.
Go for it.
It goes back. Yeah. And then I got to talk about my bandmates and how I got into this band and how that was right after retirement. And you'll relate being in a band. But and before we say any of that, we got to get you up here during gig season to come hang at a show, meet the guys, celebrate, do some stuff with us. Cause that invite is there.
Oh, I'm coming. I'll cash that invite in, man. I'll bring some pecan pie from Texas or something that'll knock your socks off out there. Some hot sauce or something.
Dude, the guys will lose their minds for that. But, yeah, let's do that. But yeah, it kind of started in junior high. I was a wind instrument player in symphonic bands. Mm-hmm. So I was playing the clarinet of all things. And like, I think it was actually fifth grade I started. I was always a big music fan. My mom and dad were into all the classics, all the, you know, a lot of bluegrass, a lot of country, a lot of rock and roll. I mean, I have the vinyl collection that I've inherited from, you know, both my mom and dad who have long since passed of, you know, early Eagles albums, you know, Blue Oyster Cult, everything from Rita Coolidge, Willie Nelson, Linda Ronstadt, and then, you know, into Fleetwood Mac and all the way up to the classics you and I, you know, are about.
Yeah.
So I started with wind instruments and got into high school marching band around other things. And it was a really, really good marching band, a band that was winning like national championships after I graduated. That happened after I graduated, but
you inspired them.
No, I just wasn't there at the right time because I was not the top dog there. Right. But it was really interesting. It was fun learning that to choreograph, you know, an arduous physical exertion set and play at the same time. And then I got pulled into like trumpet and baritone in some jazz bands for a while. In the meantime, I'm growing up in junior high and high school, being a Rush fanatic, being a Metallica fanatic, really liking a lot of those bands that, you know, hit us around junior high. And my sister was also a big 80s big hair girl and going to every rock show, you know, with her fiance and stuff. And she wanted to be a guitarist. So she got a Charvel, a really nice Charvel, you know, a Jackson bass. She got the amp. My uncle's a really good musician, set her all up in his music store. And she noodled around on it for a while and then didn't do much with it. Then she got into college and just got immersed. And we were just 2 years apart. We're both criminal justice majors at San Jose State. She's 2 years younger than me. She just retired 5 years ago from a 20-year career as a captain at San Jose Fire.
Wow.
Yeah, she was fire from the urban search and rescue on the ground up, you know, with the guys, and had a good career. But we got to a point where she wasn't playing this bass. And I remember we were at a party with my brother, and my brother had a friend named Steve Erickson, who literally could pick up a guitar and play like Joe Satriani, George Lentz, Eric Johnson, you name it. He was the guy. I mean, and he was doing this in high school. And at these parties, Steve would be there with just an amp and a drum machine throwing down a 4/4 kick and just shred. And we'd be mesmerized and we'd sit there and just watch him go from Eddie Van Halen riffs to a melodic like Satch riff. And then with his whammy bar, you know, George Lynch, we do some Dokken in the band. We're big Dokken fans. He was just tearing it up, and a good friend and a couple years younger than me. And I remember one night he said, doesn't Laura have a bass? My sister, isn't there a bass around, that new bass she got? I go, yeah, I think so. I think it's back in her closet. He goes, dude, let's get that out. You should play that. I go, I don't play bass. I barely picked up a guitar like ever. He goes, oh no, you're musical, dude. I'll show you a couple notes. And you know, you hit four notes. It'll be, you know, four, just throw me four chord notes and I'm going to play off that all night. And I plug that thing in and I just threw him down some ascend simple. I'm on the E, maybe up to an F sharp. Now I'm doing a D. And he would just change with me being the virtuoso that he was, which Mike, our guitarist in Area 56, George, Mike LaFume, I call him Captain 2.5 because he's rhythm guitar, lead singer sometimes, always a harmonizer, you know, and he always jokes like Star Trek, I'm giving her all she got, Captain, I got no more. and so I go, you're 2.5, and that's become his nickname on the band. But Mike reminds me of Steve when he was young. Mm-hmm. And so Steve is just shredding, and I'm throwing down this stuff, and I wish we had recorded it. It was before the era of smartphones. Some magic was coming out of his guitar, ascend basics of me just trying to sort of read and change it. But he goes, dude, start learning that thing. We need to work on this. And pretty soon I started playing that bass a lot. And my sister wasn't playing it. I had borrowed it. And I had one of the Mac LCs, Macintosh, first color box little computer from San Jose State that I'd been writing all my papers on. And now she needed it. And she goes, hey, can I use your LC? I go, hey, I got a plan.
Got a trade.
How about I trade you the whole, I'm going to trade you the whole system for your bass and amp. She's like, ooh, I don't know if I can let it go. I go, you really playing that thing? You haven't played it for years. She goes, no, it's a good trade because you're playing it. I need the thing. And we'll both have them in the family. So I got that guitar and then I just started jamming and, you know, playing by ear and learning notes and bass clef. I've been a treble clef player before in symphonic stuff, and I played competently, but I've never been a bass player like Seth is, or like, you know, somebody you'd see on the bands we like. Definitely not a Geddy Lee.
Right.
And at times we're doing something by Rush right now that we're working on that I'm not going to give away, where it's a bass lead. And Seth is like, oh man, this is too much. I'm like, no, it's not. You got this.
you got this, man.
Cause he's that good. But anyway, I started playing that. And then I ended up going, like, we'd have like these retirement parties for game wardens or for park rangers. And I would do solo sets over basically, you know, like karaoke music, but I'd sing and do the bass line for like a 9 or 10 song set. And people liked it. Mm-hmm. And it was weird, you know, I'm doing that, but it was a way to start. And I played at some DEA retirement parties for some headsheds and did some solo stuff. And then in 2013, when I started the whole Met thing with some other people, and that was all ramping up, and my dad was, you know, on his last leg because he passed that summer right after I soloed the Baja 500, right before we started the Met team. So it was bittersweet. The best things, most pivotal things that could happen in life happened in 2013, or we wouldn't be having this conversation. So sure. This is another blessing. And yet I lost my dad and my ex-pop-in-law within 2 months of each other. So that's one of those years that you just look back on, you know, and it breaks your heart and it elates your soul. Like, I've been blessed by the man above in so many, I can't believe this is all happening. Here we are. But that year, Josh Moore, who is a residential and commercial painter in this area of Montana and one of the best, he's been the painter for my family, the contractors, all the family builds we've done on the spread for like 20 years. And I get introduced to him because I got to bring him in because we're remodeling my dad's cabin. We're making a memorial cabin after he's passed.
Oh, nice.
He was really close to my dad. And he's going, you know, we just started a new band, man. And it's great dudes. It's called Area 56. I'm like, what's that mean? He goes, well, we're the 56th smallest county in Montana. And we got the Yeti, Sasquatch being seen all over. We got the Northern Lights. We got UFOs. So we want to put a little area. We thought, not make it a, it's not that freaky. Not Joe Rogan in the alien level, but Joe will relate to this. So Area 56, and it's all green and creepy. And I'm like, I dig that, man. That's cool. He goes, yeah, we got a lot of guys. But I know you play. And you should come out and try out. I mean, you're going to be here. I go, dude, I'm only here part-time. I'm in California for another 6 years of residency. I just started this crazy unit. I'm going to be immersed. I said, but if you guys are still together when I retire, it's a dream to be in a band with homeboys like you. So fast forward to New Year's Eve, 2018. I've been retired 20 days. They're having a New Year's Eve gig at the VFW Center in Troy, Montana. Big veteran celebration. It's like 10 below. I'm up here. They're like, yep, you're going to play a song. The guys are going to meet you that night. I go, what? What's going on here? And they play, and now I sing it, but one Rush song in set two, New World Man, that resonates off the Signals album with, you know, everybody. It's a good message, fun. And they go, yeah, we want you to sing the Rush song. So get ready. I said, okay. So I'm finding like karaoke versions of it. I'm getting through my mic system again. I haven't really played or done anything in a band in like 5 years. And I just keep hammering on it. And I probably sang that song a couple hundred times in the 2 weeks leading up to it. And then I went in to the center and everyone's dancing and they are in like the very first part of set one and they're rocking away. And I'm like, holy crap, these guys are good. These guys are really good. I mean, the technicalities of the music we play, the different songs. I went, okay. And then Josh is back there. Okay, we got our good friend John. He's up here, just retired from law enforcement. And he's going to get up here and sing. I'm like, I'm not doing it. He's like, oh, is he punking out? And then I got a kick from a family member and said, you sang this thing like 300 times in front of us. You're getting up there. You're not punking. And I went up and jumped on it and sang it. And Mike normally sings it and guitars it. And we were just eye to eye all night having a good time. And then we officially said hellos after that. I mean, I had not even met these guys yet, George. And it was magical. It was a great night. Then I started just coming to practices and hanging out. I'd sing like one song with them and then go watch and then this and that and bring other ones from their previous set list from years before. And somehow we had a talk one day, like 3 months in before the next gig season started. They go, I think John's in the band. Is John in the band? And I go, am I in the band? And they're like, yeah, you're in the band.
It's official.
But then they're like, but now you have to be a lead singer because, dude, those guys were singing 40 songs collectively between the three of them a night and playing all their instruments as three piece. And, you know, now that I'm the lead singer and sing 70% of every song we sing in a night, we're toast at the end of it, you know, in a good way. But now, you know, when you're playing a really technical part, you know this from musicianship, when you're playing that technical as a guitar player and you're singing a lead vocal for like an Aussie song, let's say, or something crazy, you know, you're going to play well because you're good, because you're rehearsed, but you're not necessarily going to play at your best when someone else is singing a lead and you come in at a harmony, right? And now everybody's just tighter.
Yeah.
You know, Josh on his technical drum part and singing from his drum kit. I took a lot of songs he used to sing because, I mean, it was a tough road.
Yeah.
And then we kind of expanded our sound a little bit, like songs they previously didn't have synthesizers and keyboards that had parts. Now I became a keyboard player and learned the synthesizer, and Seth is a programmer for samples. So I'm playing with that kid. I've got an alternate percussion set up to assist Josh when a song needs cowbell or it needs a vibra slap or it needs a rain stick, and he can't do it all,
right,
you know?
Right.
and sing it. So anyway, long-windedly, that's how it morphed. And I joined them, well, technically at the end of that night, and we're going on to our sixth year, and we're going to 11 years of Area 56. And our 100th gig was actually on New Year's last year. And they said, so we'll have been together for 10 years. We'll have 100 gigs. Maybe it's time to take a break. We got a lot of family stuff going, elderly family, you know, this and that. And we were potentially going to give it a rest last year. And not in a negative way.
Right.
Just from the standpoint of our lead guitarist and my good friend, Mike, you know, his pop had just died, or he was close to passing away. There were a lot of transitions and family changes and seeing your kids do well in high school. It was just getting a lot. And I was on the road a lot. I am by design. I mean, I don't have the family restrictions anymore, but you know, but then we started having so much fun. We were calling it our farewell tour secretly and not telling the public. And then we were having rehearsals, and we were jamming more Lights Out than we ever had with the most complicated new set list. Pearl Jam comes in, you know, Queensryche, we're playing Silent Lucidity, we're playing Jeremy, we're playing Shinedown, we're doing all these songs we would have never done as a three-piece, and we would not have done them 3 or 4 years prior with me in the band. We just weren't ready, but we had the most fun, and, you know, by those last couple shows, I'm starting to hear, yeah, I think we got to do like 6 or 8 of these next year. We're like, all right. So it's not going anywhere.
Yeah.
You know, everybody's fresh. We're having fun. And we're just looking forward to a really good gig season. But again, that's just been God's timing on everything. And, you know, putting us in face with good people. You know, had I not had that connection, I mean, I was roaming around here in Montana for 20 something plus years through my entire career, knowing I'd live here one day, but being a California resident and loving my job down there. And I never ran into any of these guys. And had it been not the family connection and Josh and I bonding over that moment when my dad passed and having to cross paths when he was actually painting the house, and I happened to be here and loving this guy and listening to music and dissecting stuff on the iTunes, we're just like, okay. And it just became a real great opportunity. And now it's been a lot of fun, And a lot of people have a lot of fun at these. We have a big summer festival, a place called Happy's Inn. We play to about 2,000 people for a little mountain band that is enormous.
Right.
And then they do a city-sized one-hour fireworks show at the end and they run the tallest flag, biggest flag in Montana above their resort and their casino and their restaurant and their store. That's in an area around McGregor Lake where everyone's camping and fishing, and halfway between our town and the big Flathead Valley of like Kalispell and Glacier Park. And yeah, it's a big show. And then we do a bunch of smaller shows, you know, but they're all just good people, you know, good people. So come see us, man. Hang out, jam with us.
Oh, I'm in, man. I am in. We'll have to lock in some dates and such too. No, yeah. That's phenomenal. Yeah. When you're not doing that, I mean, I guess I want to go into two areas. Let's first ask about, like, because you just wrapped up your hunting season for the most part. I know, you know, some spring turkeys are on the way, and I know you're a turkey man, but talk me through about what the fall was like for you. What are some highlights that you have? What can some stories you can share, and maybe what you got in the freezer?
Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned that, because what you're doing down on your ranch, and we met way back in the day over one of my podcast appearances, and you said, you got to come down here. You got Texas whitetail thing going on, and I love that. We need to make that happen. But yeah. It was a good season. I didn't harvest a buck here simply because I'm targeting three monsters that I've put up on social media anonymously, not showing locations for obvious reasons. And I've just been watching these Goliath timber whitetail that by far they're our nemesis up here in Norris Lane. My uncle and my dad, you know, my uncles have been, and my dad have been my mentors. And until you shoot, you know, a true timber buck in millions of public mountain dense timber acres, you know, in our wilderness areas, and you get that, you know, we call it a 5-point here. Western right. count, but that real mature 10-point, you would say in the East, that's, you know, a 6-7-year-old buck. And defeated, never been, until you get one of those, you don't quite join the club. And 05, that happened after 8 days, you know, put my climber stand up every day in an area we had marked and put a lot of research into. And I really credit my uncle especially for being that mentor. You know, he's the ninja in the woods. He's that guy that was super silent, read wind perfectly, taught me to fly fish, taught me to stalk. I learned more stalking tactics effective in loud timber country than I ever picked up in a sniper school. No disparage to any of the schools I was in or that I taught, but I got more of that inherent, you know, miserable weather, miserable condition, wind changes from him. And now I'm kind of going after that. You know, I don't want to shoot anything small. I want really mature bucks up here. I get, you know, the wild hogs down in Cali, the yep. true Russian razors that we're actually working on a conservation story for one of the NRA publications right now, because the cattle families down there that I've been close to, that I'm down there, you know, watching their properties for trespass grows, but also dealing with invasive hogs that are, you know, taking out all that habitat and grassland that don't only impact their cattle, but they impact the tule elk. And I'm in that part where I grew up on these ranches that have the smallest sized elk species that we have in America, but also the smallest population. There's like 4,000 of these animals, and they only exist in certain parts of California, and they're magnificent. And they're all over these ranches that I'm going after these massive Russian boars, and then dealing with these coyotes that have not been called, they have not been hunted, they have not had pressure, and they're taking out calves, you know, by the numbers, both, you know, potentially elk calves, but definitely, you know, beef cattle. Sure. And I've just been really falling back in love with that when I have the time. If I'm working on the West Coast, I'm in there every afternoon or morning that I can, and doing it all on foot, man, and doing the long range stuff, bringing back the sniper stuff, and dealing with the new guns I shoot, and Altera Arms. I got to give them a shout out. They've been my rifle sponsor, you know, since retirement. And that 300 PRC is old faithful. It is, I mean, it's a good Texas gun for about anything down there. But they built me a 6.5 Creedmoor and also a 33 Nozzler when I eventually draw that brown bear tag to do that feature.
Nice.
And those guns are just amazing. And being able to put them to work all the time, given the generosity and support I have from a company like that, and really show that it's not just about conservation field to table, which is everything. And you know, it's all important, but we're getting into legitimate depredation issues for habitat endangered species and really, really threatened species like the tule elk. Literally in the Silicon Valley foothills where all these groves were. It makes no sense. So we're actually, I'm working with a good writer, Karen Hunter, who's with Athlon Outdoors and runs Secure It Safe's kind of marketing media. We're going to be doing an article on the absolute contradiction of how can you have this sensitive wildlife like tule elk in the Silicon Valley foothills and have a coyote population next to an urban tech capital that's doing so much damage to these calves of native species, wildlife species, and our beef cattle. And how does the cattle industry fit in conservation? Most people think beef cows, they're just, you know, crapping up in the streams, they're tearing up waterways. But when you look at how grazing is done when it's done ethically and effectively, they're actually enhancing wildlife habitat in their practice. And people that aren't on the conservation side necessarily don't really understand that. And it's yeah. not disparaging anybody, but you got to just show it because they haven't been exposed to it.
Sure. You don't know until you know.
Yeah. And we're going to expose this in the stuff I'm doing when I'm on the West Coast in an article for American Hunter that's going to really lay this out to all the masses that'll read it in whatever state, in whatever city, and go, wow, this is crazy. You know, from a 400-pound true Russian razor that isn't a feral mix, hogs that were literally brought over by the Hewlett-Packard Foundation, the ranch, and I'm next to the Hewlett-Packard Ranch. That's where I operate. They're great people. They're massive. But they brought over 6 wild hogs, 2 Russian boars, and 4 sows in 1963. And you should see what happened to that part of California. But when I'm shooting hogs, it's none of this feral, weird mixed pigs. It's these big razorback, stout shoulder, gristle plate. You've seen some of the photos.
Yeah.
I posted a few. And the coyotes look like winter dogs that are eating drive-through at McDonald's up here in Montana all day long. They're monstrous dogs. They're getting no pressure. And then I'm seeing them in the cities. So yep. That's what's been the good stuff. But we ended up with some hog meat, ended up with some deer meat, ended up with 2 nice turkeys fall and spring last year. And then I'm just waiting on a brown bear tag to go up and do a little film up there and go after the big brown bear and talk about predation issues up there. And also dive in with experts on the cartel fentanyl and methamphetamine and human trafficking issue going in overdrive all around Alaska, especially, and how remote Alaska, say a Fognak Island or Kodiak, where I'm going to be, is affected by the cartel threat. I always want to bring in an element of what do we need to be careful of, as well as we tell a conservation story on my Thin Green Line film series. And that's kind of where we're going. That's just a hard tag to draw. It's been 3 years in the making. So we'll see.
Oh, well, good luck. Hope you get that, man. And I love how you're talking about, you kind of do like one big major video each year, right? Wasn't that always your goal? I mean, are you kind of doing some more aside from that one? What else is on the horizon? Because I know that you filmed a lot last year, and what are we looking to see as far as that kind of feature coming out?
Yeah, we got a couple things. Some I can talk about just in general for now.
Yeah, of course.
Basically, we started filming last year for the Call Sign Trailblazer documentary / Hidden War documentary. And then the writers and actors strike started.
Right.
And it shut everything down because people, you know, we were thinking we could continue pushing through with the documentary. But when you start to bring in reenactments, you're using actors for that. Even a non-scripted documentary has an issue there. I mean, we couldn't even have Mustafa Speaks, who plays Nate Romanowski on the Joe Pickett series.
Yep.
On, he was wanting to do our podcast for the longest time. Then the strike happened. He couldn't even do a podcast appearance. And then that we just got him on the show about a month ago when everything lifted. Well, now that things are lifted, we're back on for documentary production. There is a feature film in the works. It has not been greenlit. It's in development right now for Hidden War. What I can say is we have an amazing writer, three amazing producers involved in it. That's what I'll say for now.
Yeah.
And let's just say the story is going to be more than I could have expected. More than I could have expected because this writer and these producers are wired right. They completely get it. I think it's going to complement everything we stand for on the conservation front. And it's not going to water down the real threats from these cartels that we have out there. It's going to be painfully honest. And it's going to get a little more personal than I thought it would to deal with some of the, you know, the different challenges just to get this team built, you know. And the things that were happening, you know, with losses in family, when one of what I think is one of the best things I was ever blessed to do during my operational career. So I'll have more on that as we develop, but really, really good blessings in the works. So 2024, it's going to be a busy year, but I'm going to make time for this. And I got to apologize because we've been trying to get this on for the better part of a year. So I'm grateful for your patience, brother.
Of course.
I appreciate all you're doing. Keep it up. And someday I got to get down on your ranch and play a little bit and look at your program because it's really exemplary, really impressive.
Cheers. Well, thank you, man. Well, you know, that offer is always open. Love to have you. Love to share, you know, what we got out there and like to see what you got going on. I appreciate all that you're, you know, educating and, you know, entertaining on the music side too, but well, everything that you're putting out there and that you're sharing with the world, you have great guests on when you've had your podcast. There's so much that I have learned through following you and your journey and your writings. Your books are second to none. I think they open up something that people really need to see. And I mean, I find them to be fascinating left and right. Like I said, I've given these as gifts, the V knives that you created, everything around there has been so, you know, I'm blessed to just kind of be a part of this journey and learn. And I'm always excited because you never know what month you're going to announce the next big thing, man. So everyone should stay tuned and follow your page. And we'll give them a location on where to do that in a second and follow the journey. But, you know, when we talk about all these different things you've been a part of, you know, your amazing career and service, and thank you for that as well. And I just wanted to know, you know, I've asked a lot of guests about their legacy, and I was really curious about how you view your own personal and professional legacy. Obviously, you've uncovered so much, you've shared so much of with your books and just through your time and your service and what you've seen as a game warden there. And I wanted to hear about what you think, you know, as far as that idea of legacy, man. What do you hope that you leave behind? How do you want to be remembered? And like I said, in a professional and a personal side of life.
Yeah, I think I'll go personal first. And I think I just want to honor the legacy of my mom and my dad. You know, my mom passed at 47 years old back in 93, like literally when I was just in my early 20s, start my career. And I'll tell you what, man, she was a best friend. She was a confidant. And the years I did have with her, she always spoke from the heart of generosity. And she had a couple of rules. She said, you know, never have an empty plate for a guest. She said, if there's anything worth doing, you need to do the best. It's worth overdoing. And that was before it was even, you know, a movie line. That was her saying. Yeah, it truly was. And I didn't know how impactful that would be later in my career. But yeah, dad was the same way, you know. They both said, find something you're passionate about and do it to the best of your ability. And whatever you do passionately, do it to make a difference for better. make people better, make people happy, make people safer. And it was kind of embedded in a service history anyway. My dad was Army National Guard and Reserves. Granddad was career Navy. All my uncles served. My dad served. And if they didn't serve in the military, they were law enforcement guys,
right,
or gals. So I kind of had that public service was going to be a part of me at some point. I didn't know if it was going to be a military journey. I didn't know if it was going to be domestic law enforcement. I was going to start my career as an engineer directly out of college, because I knew as a civil engineer, I could do outdoor type stuff. I could make a decent living for my family. We had grown up, you know, with very limited resources. And thankfully I found that game warden by mistake on that winter hike, you know, back of, I know we didn't talk about it, but it's in the intro.
Yeah,
of Warden,
yeah.
Woods, and I've told the story a few
great
times.
Story. Yeah, sure.
And you know, and that's when I was going the engineering route and looking at the ROTC special forces bill that they had, which they did for Green Berets. And that's where I was going until I met that game warden and realized this is something I need to do now. And I need to serve domestically, because I was so impassioned by the outdoors. They were healing. They were motivating. All of my trail runs, my long distance, any of my endurance sports happened in Henry Coe State Park, even if I wasn't hunting. And it gave me the strength to do what I do today, you know, and have gotten through, I think, successfully. And that I'm still here to talk about it with you, because we had a lot of close calls, as you can imagine. But basically pay it forward, you know. Do something for the greater good and just be rewarded for yourself. So everything I do is really for the message. It's really for protecting wildlife resources and public safety. I love our country. I absolutely love the blessings we have. I will never disparage another nation, but I've been all over the world, and I can say even in our worst day, we've never had something better. And my legacy is to be that person to say, it's worth fighting for, to protect. Be good to everybody around you. You know, be humble, be a simple man. And one of the songs I brought to the band that we had to play two seasons ago, and it was my mom's message, be a simple man. And Skinner got it right. Shinedown did it great. Whoever's covered that. Mm-hmm. I can't tell you how emotional I get on stage and the crowd gets when we talk about that. And I always tribute that to my mother, who died so early, and my dad's legacy. And that's on the personal, that's a little bit of personal and professional. Yeah. I think it kind of answers it both. Did I get it right? Or did it make sense?
Did I get my legacy right? No, it does, man. I mean, it starts the family there too, but I think, you know, your history of your family being, you know, people of service, men and women, and, you know, to be then you wanting to be a part of something and giving back, and you found your calling, you found the thing that you really felt was right for you at that time. And then to see where that career took you and the things that, you know, the unexpected, I bet you never could have written out this journey
in
the sense of what it came through, and, you know, this illegal growth, the cartel and the influence. And now here you are, you know, if you would have told your 22-year-old self then, hey, by the way, you're going to be testifying to Congress and, you know, talking to them about these issues, you would have been like, what, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And you're gonna be playing in a very nice, successful rock band. But you know, like those things that you never know where your journey is gonna take. But you know, as long as I think you stick to, you know, your core beliefs, you're honoring yourself, your family, and you know, you're wanting to give back and you stay true and trying to be a better person each day, no matter what it is you're gonna do, you're gonna leave behind something that's going to be monumental. And you know, everything you've done, I mean, I always think about these kinds of things too, like podcast, right? There's like a little nugget of our timeline that we've left behind, you know, you being a podcaster too, like, and then you look at your books and then, you know, your musical recordings and things that people can sit back. There's a certain point in time where your life lives on through that echoing continuation of all the things that you've produced and been a part of. How many articles have you written? I mean, it's all there for us to go through. And, you know, I'm honored to have you on here and to talk to you about this. And I appreciate the legacy you live in. I appreciate all that you're doing right now and sharing with, you know, my listeners and friends and family. You've been a very important person in my life, man. And I'm just so thankful to all the things that you're doing and putting out in the world. And it's just a great thing to be on the journey of. And you always got my support. If there's anything I can ever do to, you know, help accentuate or, you know, throw a spotlight on what you got going, we're going to get you back on here and throw that out there. So I just want to say thank you. And for those who are wanting to learn more about what you got going, will you give us websites, your social handles, your podcast, just like kind of give a little review of everything so people can dive in and jump in where they want?
You bet. We'll start with website, George. And by the way, honored to be here, brother. Thank you for having me. And I look forward to just continuing the process, man. This has been an amazingly fun conversation, and I appreciate it. You can reach me. My website's just johnnorris.com, johnnorris.com. It has most of the updates with books and TV and projects, teaching, speaking. I do speak all over the country on these issues. If anybody wants that, I'm going to be on the road a lot March and April, multiple states with law enforcement teams primarily, but civilian groups as well, conservation groups. I'm on Instagram at John Norris, J-O-H-N-N-O-R-E-S. There's a lot of posers trying to steal my content. So look for the blue check.
Yes.
Because I fortunately got that blue check recently, because I had a lot of people being scammed by by some faker out there being asked for money and all kinds of goofy stuff. So
I remember getting one of those. Yeah. They're like, yeah, I'm arrested. I need money. I'm like, oh, really?
Oh yeah. Yeah. Good luck with that.
I was like, that's funny. So, yeah. You're the second John Norris account. You're not the real one. Yeah. But I remember there was something like that. It was crazy.
No, it really happens, man. And on Facebook, same thing, just J-O-H-N-N-O-R-E-S. The thing you'll see is on my link tree, it'll get you to my Recoil TV films. Part of Recoil TV. Also, my YouTube channel is just the Thin Green Line John Norris YouTube channel. And it has everything from full films to documentaries to news pieces to product testing of the very gracious sponsors I get to work with, and some diversity there. And I encourage anybody to reach out if you have anything you want to know about going into the game warden career. More on the cartel issue, more on the issues we face in America, anything I can help in any way, please email me. And you'll get to my email. It's trailblazer413@yahoo.com, but you'll get to it through the website as well. And I can't tell you how many kids and how many adults I'm hearing from that have gone into the career that I've never met from other countries, other states, or people that I've, you know, worked with growing up as an instructor, as a warden, that are now behind me, you know, doing the best job they possibly can. And I'm glad to help out and answer questions. So reach out to me that way as well.
Well, and are you still doing tactical training as well right now?
I'm doing a little bit of it.
Okay, because that was another level that you've done before that I wanted to make sure I mentioned. I mean, that we could be sitting here for 5 hours, like talking about all the different things. But yeah. I just, if you're still involved with that, I wanted to just have you give a plug on that and what people can expect when, you know, through your firearms training.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, George. And I do have that on my website, especially as a tactical training element. I can pull off about 4 classes a year, mm-hmm. between one-on-one up to 1-on-4. And I'll do them on the West Coast in certain conditions and certain ranches I have access to, excuse me, and also up here in Montana. And it's a 2-day pistol and carbine combination. There's some wilderness trauma medicine involved, or it can be just one weapon for a day, and then you can go to the long gun from the pistol. But I work from the basics and, you know, work you right up to being the best prepared person you can to be your first self, you know, your first responder. For field conditions, whether you live in an urban or rural environment, and also going over all the legalities of being prepared to what will happen if you ever have to execute deadly force for defense, or also bring in those weapon skills to subsist under the conservation model. I teach that as well. And inquiries can come through direct message on Instagram or Facebook, or you can email me as well if you're interested in that. And we have a lot of fun in those classes, and I don't do a ton of them because of the schedule,
sure,
but I make sure I can do them enough to stay current and fresh out there. And, you know, while I'm in training myself with other groups, so yeah. Good stuff.
Well, hey, once again, everyone, make sure you go check out those links. There's so much to explore, and you know, whether however we do this, I want to get some books from you and give them away to our listeners. We'll do a giveaway where they can follow your pages. We'll talk the details about that, but there will be a giveaway of some sort, whether I'm, you know, getting them from you, or maybe we'll figure out what kind of combination of stuff, but I want to do something to where people can get a chance to really jump in. Make sure you guys are ordering Hidden War, the second edition, the foreword by Jack Carr. It's phenomenal. I love this, and I know that there's more things that are on the horizon. Can't wait to have you on to chat about all those and just to see all these amazing projects unfold. Thank you once again, John, for joining me. And it's been a pleasure and honor. I can't wait to do this in person.
Right on, brother. Look forward to seeing you. Look forward to the next one, and keep up the good work.
Cheers.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.